And he started working over the crowd after the announcement had been made, and the man next to me put back his 5 and took out a 10. As one example of how you can, you know, increase your profits. I guess that's the best way to put it, just by a few well-chosen words. But there's no command, goodness, teachers always dream of having people at their feet, but I didn't bargain for anything like this. But it is a hot topic, okay, and that's why I want to talk about it. And I should say a little bit about background. Is there somebody who can? We used to have ushers, you know, who remember church? You'd have ushers who'd run around and get the old hard folding chairs. Or if you grew up as I did, you remember those old rickety dark brown wooden ones?
Yes.
Right, slats. Oh yeah. And you'd wobble and wiggle on those, and you'd try to hold your balance, and you were sure glad when whatever it was going on in Fellowship Hall in the basement was over, because you weren't sure that those churches, are there any people who still have those wonderful old chairs left, you know, in use? I mean, they may be in museums where they probably belong. I was just curious.
You mean those things that pinch you when you fold them up?
Yeah, yeah.
My uncle's got 20 of them. We use them at the family reunion.
Family reunion, right.
Kind of a...
I could pun on that with pinches and things like that, but I won't. Okay. Anyway, I'd like to make the case as to why this is, you know, an important topic. I'll do that as we go through this. And also explain for some of you who haven't heard my presentations before that I just finished this summer a manuscript which I call Religion and Politics, the American Way. And then the subtitle is The New Christian Right, 1981 to 1986. And that's a follow-up on the book which I did for Oxford Publishing, which came out in 1981, simply called The Politics of Moralism. And I can say that because that book, The Politics of Moralism, is out of print, which means I don't make any royalties on it, which means that I'm not giving it a commercial or a plug here. And anyway, as some of you know, writing for Oxford Publishing Company at your house is not a profit-making enterprise. Well, that's another story. We'll get into it. Okay. But it is a very important subject, and it's an important subject because it raises issues really in American politics which really significantly haven't been raised before. There are those who argue that, well, we did have a full-fledged, well-recognized clergy run for the presidency in 1984 with Jesse Jackson, and I want to talk about that a little bit. So why get excited now that we have one more, well-known, if you like, celebrity preacher running for the presidency in 1988? And I want to talk about maybe there's some sort of similarity between those two, those two phenomena. But he is being taken seriously. There are always lots of different sort of minor party people who run for office, but Robertson's been taken very seriously. He's got money, he's got momentum, he's a media event, as we call it. He's a photo opportunity. I'll talk a little bit about the Michigan primary, where he first came into his own in terms of national publicity, and then raised some questions about his standing within the conservative evangelical community and within the Republican Party itself, and then have some time for discussion. Okay, first of all, three or four things to say straight out, and I think they'll be self-explanatory when I say these sort of things, because they raise his candidacy has raised certain kinds of issues. First thing it has to be said right away is that any native-born American citizen who is 35 years of age or older, who has been born, you know, in one of the 50 states, is eligible to run for the United States presidency. That's just a flat-out statement. If you're 35 or older, you are eligible to run. I'm sorry?
Male.
I didn't say that, Emily. I just said any citizen. And you know what Reagan said about that? Yes, there will be a woman president of the United States, and she'll be a Republican. That's what Ronald Reagan said, and if you don't like it, you know, write him. That's what he said. Okay. And there are those who are talking about Jeannie Kirkpatrick. You know, that's vice president for 1988, isn't she? She's, I guess, a hot property for 1988 in political terms. Okay. Secondly, the Constitution also provides that there should be no religious test for public office. No religious test for public office. That goes way back to the 18th century decision to keep, by the founding fathers, to keep, you know, a sharp separation of church and state. And you remember that came up very sharply in 1980 when then Senator John F. Kennedy was being criticized for simply being a Roman Catholic, and there were those who were saying that as a Roman Catholic he couldn't run for the presidency. He could be a United States senator. I haven't figured out the paradox there yet, but he could be a United States senator, but he couldn't be a president. And he quite rightly pointed to Article 4 in the Constitution: no religious test for office. And that has to be said as clearly and as firmly as possible. Thirdly, not so much in a constitutional matter, but there are those who argue that, well, is it really seemly for a minister to get into the political process, to kiss babies and shake hands and fly around the country and hold press conferences and do all the rest of these sorts of things? It's seemly, I think it's seemly because, or appropriate because that's what we want our presidential candidates to do. We're no longer in the old dark horse stages where, or the smoke-filled room, you know, positions where the candidate can come out of nowhere. Wendell Willkie was the last dark horse candidate, and that was 1940. That was only because nobody wanted to run against FDR. I mean, Tom Dewey didn't want to run against him, and Senator Taft from Ohio didn't want to run against him, and hence they found a former Democrat, just like Reagan, to run against FDR in 1940 with this. So the dark horse thing is over. It takes at least 2 years and probably even more to get your apparatus in gear or to get your machinery in motion. Right now, for instance, and it's all of this is totally legal, George Bush, the vice president, has a very active campaign going in the states which are going to be the first states to have primaries. He's got people up in New Hampshire. Of course, you have to be careful about New Hampshire because Walter Mondale had people in New Hampshire for 2 years and blew it. Does it do that much good? Maybe New Hampshire's, you know, too small. But anyway, it's not inappropriate, I think, for anybody who's running for office to start this early. And we expect our candidates to really start right away. As soon as Reagan was re-elected, once that story was over, the next story was who's going to be the candidate, you know, in 1988. We're running 4 years ahead of time. And that runs the risk, obviously, of people burning out or front runners. Remember Estes Kefauver in 1952 with the old coonskin cap as a candidate who burned out. I like talking to people, you know, my age and older because they remember people like Tom Dewey and Estes Kefauver. And some of the others. I talked about this the other time I was here, and it's fun because I see some nods, and that's always good. Okay, finally, in terms of sort of general principles about the candidacy of any individual, my own personal feeling is, and I think you can see where I'm going with these statements that I've made so far, my own personal feeling is that when we have a candidate making a serious candidacy or run at the presidency, I think no matter how unusual the platform may be, unless it's something like treason or something like that, which would be kind of a silly exaggeration, but no matter how unusual the platform might be, I think it should be taken seriously by the voters. Every candidate has a platform, and I think every candidate's platform should be taken seriously on the basis of the merits of the platform. What I'm saying there is that it's much more important for the success of the American form of politics to base your decisions on the basis of the platform rather than on the basis of personality. That's very, very important and can't be overstressed. And since we don't have the European, what we call the parliamentary system of this, and since we do have television, and I'm not going to go into the whole lament about what television has done to change American politics and everything, the fact that Abraham Lincoln would never have been elected president, which I think is true because he was homely and had warts and had a high voice and his clothes didn't fit, and wouldn't know how at all to greet guests in the White House or the Oval Office or the Rose Garden or anything else. That aside, I think it's fair to say that the most important thing is to look at the candidate on the basis of the platform, and I would think that kind of examination should be held for all the people, for all the candidates that are put forward, not just one who happens to be a better speaker, or happens to be more photogenic, or happens to be whatever advantage somebody might have on this. And I recognize the need, obviously, for photogeneity, I guess you could call that, from television, and how that has changed their lives, but that's another story. Okay, now, what I want to try to do, and I apologize ahead of time here for reading from a manuscript, but in one way, since I'm a historian, I can say this is a historic moment, not to get excited about that, because the only other people who have seen the manuscript so far are my editors, and they have things to say about this, and I hope you have things to say about this. Editors get paid to say things about writers' manuscripts. So I say that only because I haven't really sort of committed this to memory. I was informed when I was taking my first course in speech in college that the most significant thing you could learn, you remember old Ralph Hogan, Don, was my speech teacher. the most significant thing I could do was to have significant eye contact. It didn't really matter what Ralph was saying, it really didn't matter much what you said. But if I had significant eye contact, I could, I could move mountains or whatever. Never did get that far, but I won't have significant eye contact for a while. That's what I'm trying to say. And I don't know what to do about that. I could stand up and read it off a lectern here, but I don't want to do that. Okay. Now, I want to pick up the story here right after the election or the re-election of President Reagan in 1984, because in a very real sense, that was a referendum on the candidacy, on the personality, to be sure, and on the legislative achievements of President Reagan. And since, as I talked about last week here, the new Christian right identified directly, especially on what we call the social agenda issues, with President Reagan, then obviously the new Christian right interpreted the 1984 elections as a mandate or as an order, is whatever you want to call it, full steam ahead to go ahead with their particular kinds of programs. And by social agenda, for people who weren't here last week, I mean, for instance, resistance to legal abortion. I mean, keeping the lid or the coffin on the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment. I mean, resistance to those movements by gay and lesbian groups for greater protection by what we call civil rights legislation. I'm talking about tuition tax vouchers by parents who have children in public schools for some sort of tax break on their 1040 if they send their children to private schools with this. And the last one, of course, would be voluntary school prayer. These are considered the five crucial areas in what we call the social agenda, which are promoted the most strongly by what I call the new Christian right, and by that I mean people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and Jimmy Swaggart and some of the others whom we talked about a little bit, I guess, on Saturday, and I'd be glad to talk about those in greater detail, but since this is on Robertson, we'll go into that. And what happened was that after 1984, a very significant shift took place in the leadership of the new Christian right. Falwell fully expected that since he was the founder of the first group, the Moral Majority was founded in 1979, I was going to say 1799, but they aren't that old-fashioned in their, in their ideology. That was a Freudian slip of some kind, I guess. But anyway, since it was founded in 1979, he more or less expected to wear the mantle of leadership for the new Christian right into the second term. Although Falwell has said, and I don't question his sincerity at all, that he wants to stay a preacher, he has no interest in elective office. And I have no reason to doubt that at all. Okay. But Falwell moved ahead thinking that there was going to be some sort of progress in terms of his leadership in the program. But then some of you remember it was in August of 1985, I'm sorry, that he made his incredible statement about Bishop Tutu being a phony. And more than anything else, and this is by his own admission and by his own published statements about what that did for his income, he started losing enormous amounts of money and prestige, wasn't invited back so much to be interviewed on the TBS or the Ted Bird, the Turner broadcast system, or didn't have his picture in People magazine so many times, or Donahue, or any of the other usual things, the media events that that American people like. And instead, in fact, the things got so bad, some of you remember with Falwell, he even had to change the name of his organization from Moral Majority to Liberty Federation. But he picked up something very interesting, and this is part of the thickening plot that we're going to see up here in a little while. He also picked up the full, put it the other way, he fully endorsed George Bush, vice president, for the presidency. Right away, knowing ahead of time, you see, that Pat Robertson was going to declare for the presidency, but letting it be known that he, Jerry Falwell, was staking his own territory and defending his own turf, and he wasn't going to join in any kind of stampede over to rush everybody rushing behind somebody else who may or may not happen to agree with his own particular kind of politics with that. And that's, I think, very, very important. All right. But Robertson himself started moving as early as 1985 towards some sort of position where he would be better known and more clearly understood on the basis of the general public, and not just his CBN or his Christian Broadcast Network or 700 Club, if you like, programming. And he started speaking out, starting especially early in 1985, on more issues concerned with the issues that would concern the President of the United States. beforehand when he had gotten started. Some of you know, maybe I should have said a little bit about a background from him. He was born into one of the most distinguished political families in the country. His father was a United States Senator. He was a graduate of Yale Law School. He went on to a general theological seminary in New York City. Joined the Southern Baptist Church, bought out a very small little television broadcasting system in Virginia Beach, and then in 1961 started his program. Didn't really get off the ground for a long time until he found the right kind of formula that worked. And the right kind of formula was the kind of having a program, a 90-minute program, five times a week, very much patterned after the old original Tonight Show with Jack Parr with a sidekick, a genial host or, you know, assistant host who would sort of warm up the audience and then get people in and talk to them for 15, 20 minutes and then move in for the next guest and maybe have some, you know, some music or whatever it is in between. And that formula worked, especially since he was talking about things that they didn't talk about on things like the Jack Parr or the Johnny Carson show, but people were familiar with that particular format. That's the only point I want to make. I was talking a little bit about this last time, about the connection between can you really have a significantly religious program using the format really of what we would call, you know, broadcast or commercial television. And a lot of people were familiar with that format, so they weren't in any real sense challenged when they saw the congenial host, you know, doing all these things and having all the, you know, the station breaks at the same time, and the, you know, the guest celebrities coming in. And the man I always remember was the fellow who does Tony the Tiger commercials. And that would be a very good example of somebody who gets the attention of everybody because you know that deep voice that goes way, way down. And then after talking a little bit about doing the Tony, that Frosted Flakes, is that the one for Tony the Tiger? Boy, it's been a long time. Then obviously onto some more significant and what we would call more religious kinds of attitudes that he expressed. All right, but getting away from that, Robertson started moving more directly and closely in 1985 towards foreign policy issues, trying to make himself, and he said this straight out, more credible to the voters. Because there were those who said, and there are those who still say, that perhaps if he was running for public office, he could have chosen, you know, a sort of a slightly less, you know, powerful position than the most powerful position in the world, since he had never had, since he had never had any direct experience in politics himself. He had been, since his adult days, directly involved in television evangelism. He had never pressed doorbells, stuffed envelopes, kissed babies, gone out, and done the hard work, really, that a lot of politicians have had to do. A famous story, a wonderful story, an insight, for instance, when, just to give you an example, with the Nixons, Pat, for instance, would have to stand in 3-inch heels up in some little high school gymnasium on a drafty March night in New Hampshire and shaking hands and pretend that she really enjoyed meeting every one of those voters. Well, you can draw your own conclusion whether she or Jane Mondale or anything who had to do the same thing had to do the same and ask for their recipe for chocolate chip cookies and because those were the ones which the young Republicans had brought that night and do all the high kind of hardcore things about going out and pressing the flesh and meeting the voters that the other candidates have done all the time. And there were those who argued that maybe this would have done, you know, Robertson some good to have gone out and had to press the flesh and write press releases and meet deadlines and budgets and all the rest of these things rather than going the way that he did. But anyway, he went in that particular, you know, that particular direction and started speaking out more directly on foreign policy issues, on national issues that he hadn't really taken up really very much before. And he fully endorsed this thing I've called the social agenda, the 5 points that we talked about there, plus taking a very strong stand, for instance, on support for the Contras, for instance, in Nicaragua, rather than for the Sandinista organization. Took a very strong stand, for instance, in South Africa. He warned, and I'll do get to the manuscript here, he warned against what he called Marxist communists in South Africa who would make life for the blacks there far worse than what they had now experienced. He made strong statements and continued to make strong statements, as I said, on the other kinds of issues that we've talked about here. Okay. Now, by contrast to Falwell's fortunes, this is from the manuscript, Robertson continued to maintain a growing rate of acceptance by the viewers of religious television. His loyalty to the new Christian right was as pointed in that of Falwell, but he avoided making the kind of shoot from the hip commentaries by which his own admission Falwell could not avoid. This is one thing. Falwell sometimes gets nervous and just sort of lets fly with things about Bishop Tutu being a phony, and then regrets it afterwards. Once he made up a whole story that didn't exist about President Carter, you remember, consulting with homosexuals before going ahead with some sort of thing, and then when pressed on it, he said he'd simply invented the story. Robertson has obviously profited from this a great deal and simply doesn't make those kinds of statements. All right, and this is, in my estimate, Robertson had become, to his viewers, obviously not to everybody, I'll give some statistics on that, to his viewers he became a sort of fundamentalist Walter Cronkite, authoritative, calm, in command, perfectly attuned to the demands of the pressures of the wizardry of television. He seemed to be the person they could trust to explain what were obviously some very exceedingly and complicated and often frightening implications of survival in an increasingly hostile world. And then I want to go into specifically here the candidacy which he has developed and which is for us all today. Now, observers pointed out he was the first major candidate for the presidency whose career had been focused exclusively in television and not in public life. I think if you look, for instance, at all the candidates here of the Republicans who are running in 1988, all of these are professional politicians. And all of them five of them are United States senators, and one is, of course, Jack Kemp is the United States representative. Howard Baker, some of you might wonder, he was, majority leader for a long time and retired in 1984, wasn't it? I think Howard Baker retired in 1984 to get things started. At this point, the first man whose whole career has been exclusively in television. Television had produced its first, but perhaps not its last, high office seeker. You see, this is one thing that I think we might want to talk about. Is this the best place to train people for high public office, to be, full-time in television? It's something I would like to throw out as something we might talk about before. On the other hand, while not being in public office in the sense of having to stand for office and run for election and do those things I talked about before, he had served before as the director of a corporation, he had served as director of the Christian Broadcast Network University, and he had been a member of a board of several different corporations, so he's had that kind of public experience. And as I said, he grew up in the home of a United States senator on this. Okay, the first hints of his candidacy emerged in 1985, after several other candidates had announced their plans. When asked why he wanted to run, this is a very important point, when he asked why he wanted to run against Bush or Dole or Baker or Kemp, and I put those four up as the right now, I think, are those, if you had to pick the first four runners, those would be the ones. These are not in alphabetical order, and there's no sneaking, agenda that I have here about not putting people in alphabetical order. But asked why he did want to run against Bush or Dole or Baker or Young, he said this, and I quote him, George, meaning George Bush, George is a wonderful person. We traveled together to the Sudan this spring. This was 1985. Bob Dole is a marvelous majority leader of the Senate. Howard Baker was an equally skillful majority leader. And Representative Jack Kemp is a personal friend of mine. Didn't say anything critical about any of them. They're not going to start, sniping, before they have to. Yet, I think the major problem we face is the moral state of the people. I'm talking about the need for a spiritual reliance on God, a spirit of patriotism, a spirit of giving, a spirit, if you like, of self-sacrifice for noble goals. Unless we reinstate that spirit in our people, we will continue to look to Washington for increasingly large handouts, bailouts, and solutions. I believe from a moral and spiritual standpoint, I would be better able to address that particular point of view, and also perhaps to build a national consensus to support that point of view than maybe any of the other candidates. That's how he differentiates himself from the other candidates. To build a national consensus on the basis of what he called a moral and spiritual standpoint. Then he made various consultations with others. He consulted with Falwell, with Kennedy, some of the names I had on the board last time, Tim LaHaye, Bill Bright, and others. And when asked about the support of other evangelical preachers for him, he said this, "I'm amazed at the unanimity of evangelical support. I am being encouraged from every sector, from very conservative fundamentalists to centrist evangelicals to charismatic Pentecostals." In 1985, just to go through the information on this, Robertson created a political action group called the Freedom Council. It's a tax-exempt political network with volunteer lobbyists employing 50 of the staff, projecting an annual budget of $5.5 million, and with a total of 60,000 dues-paying members in the 50 states. The council freely acknowledged its support by the Christian Broadcast Network. And this is one thing I'm saying in the book, is that I titled the chapter on here, Access Way to Power. If you want to get into power, one sure way of getting into power in this country nowadays is to get to be, you know, a television celebrity. And you have enormous kinds of influences which wouldn't have been possible, you know, 10, maybe even 5 years ago with that. All right. Having talked with a lot of people, he still didn't announce and still formally hasn't announced his candidacy for this. But on the other hand, he did add a 24-seat jet aircraft. He drew plans for a tax-exempt think tank called National Perspectives Institute, and we renewed ties with some old friends from the New Right, and continued his attack on what we call the social agenda. Now, what's interesting and what I want to talk about here is not the fact so much, with one exception here, that he was criticized from the left or from the liberals. I don't think that's much of a surprise to anybody, because this is simply a part of the American political dialogue. But here is what I would like to point out as being rather interesting. His candidacy met with sharp, often unexpected resistance from some conservatives, who we would call people of, you know, religious bent. Billy Graham announced in late 1985 that while Robertson was knowledgeable about foreign affairs, quote Graham here, "I've written Pat and said I wouldn't take part in any partisan politics." Another New Republican reporter named Fred Barnes reported on those evangelicals who rejected Robertson's apparent, quote, emergence as the designated Christian candidate for the White House. This is something which I think Robertson is trying to do very clearly, is appoint himself as the designated Christian candidate for the White House. Robertson further, according to Barnes, appeared naive about potential criticism from those believers who rejected his positions on faith healing, for instance, or speaking in tongues, or other positions he has in the Bible. They worried, these are the evangelicals, that his candidacy would in effect be putting Christianity on trial. And I think that's a very important point, that if he's running and if he's a candidate, he, in running strongly as a person so directly connected with a specific religious position, wouldn't he be asking people then sort of to vote up or down on the basis of his religious faith, rather than what I talked about before, on the basis, you see, of his specific program and candidacy on taxes and foreign policy and tariffs and all the other foreign, you know, defense and all the rest of these things that go along. It's possible that it might become a referendum on, you know, on religious faith, which I think would cause a certain number of questions that have already appeared. In fact, already, and I'll give two examples of this, his candidacy has made a serious difference in terms of the national political dialogue. Now, not unexpectedly, Robertson's bid met with very sharp criticism from the chair of the Democratic National Committee, a man named Paul G. Kirk. And Kirk's criticism proved, if nothing else, that Robertson was being taken seriously. In a fundraiser to Democrats, Kirk charged Robertson, quote, openly and aggressively advocates political action to achieve his primary goal, making America a place where everyone has the same extremist values and views of morality. On this, Kirk, and that's close quote, Kirk argued that Robertson would abolish public education, squelch the ERA, outlaw abortion, require a certain quota of born-again Christians to serve in civil service positions, and of course to increase military spending. Robertson quickly replied to this, I mean the injection by the Democratic Party of some rather sharp, you know, criticism. Robertson quickly replied by calling the charges virulent anti-Christian bigotry, proof the Democrats were starting, quote, a full-scale attack on the participation of Christians in the electoral process. That's bigotry and that's religious discrimination, according to Robertson. If Kirk had written the same thing about Rabbi Tannenbaum, you would have heard the roof fall in. Very sharp pointed thing. If it had been a Jewish rabbi who had said these things, and if the Democratic candidate, the Democratic chair, had made these criticisms, there would have been enormous, disagreement. But since it was Pat Robertson, obviously, Robertson was sort of fair game. And I've got I guess I can save that for later. I've got another quotation from this sort of thing. All right. Just skipping over some other things here. Throughout the early months of the campaign, he was asked once by a reporter from the Conservative Digest, "What do you see as the most important issue, and what can we do about it?" Putting it right on the line, and I quote him here: "Ultimately, the social issues are going to depend on the willingness of the people themselves to live according to the Judeo-Christian morality, and I believe that we need a return to morality in our country. Now, the government obviously can take a lead. calling people to a sense of moral worth, to a return to the traditional family values, the dignity of life, and these other things that we have held dear for so many years. And with that, he has sort of staked out that particular position. He's ready, obviously, for more action. But what's interesting to me, looking as I do at the conservatives, is that he hasn't gained yet, and we can talk about this, a strong consensus of support from other conservatives. Let me choose probably one of the best known in this country, Charles Colson, who I think all of us remember from Watergate days, and who's continued very active in things like Prison Fellowship and other conservative programs along this. Charles Colson produced what in some observers' evaluations was the most searching criticism of all. And I quote Colson here. No one's criticism carries the weight of Colson's. I mean, that's another person who's saying that Colson's criticism have to be taken very, very seriously. Okay. Colson found cause to enter into the battle over Robertson after listening to some television preachers who, quote, sound like they've just hung up on a private session with him before going on the air. Him with a capital H. As to Robertson, Colson stated the presidency would not be something a Christian leader could run for, but something he's drafted for, and there's only one capital P person who could do the drafting. Colson criticized the idea that he found within the new Christian right that something close to the kingdom would be ushered in when the social agenda, which I've talked about here, became law. Politics to Colson, simply by necessity, had to do with the secular issues of the what we call the regular world. Religious faith, according to Colson, must be kept isolated from that enough to stand in prophetic judgment of its pretensions. That's a word, a phrase worth going over again. That religious faith must be kept isolated from the world enough to stand in prophetic judgment of its pretensions. And one observer summarized Colson's comments that there is simply too much eagerness in fundamentalist political activism. The exploitation of direct mail, the proliferation of political action committees, or PACs, the slick and lavish promotional efforts. They may have been pushed, talking about TV preachers, they may have been pushed into politics, but now they like the game an awful lot. Close quote. Pat Robertson has spoken out on that. This is an interesting reply that he makes. He states that God used oak trees, not mushrooms. In other words, if you're going to have Christians in public life, you have to have tall, stately oak trees, not mushrooms, not the meek and the lowly. There are those who argue, for the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes and blessed are the poor and the meek and all the other things. And how are you going to be poor and meek and mild and all the rest of these things if you've got an annual income of $223 million? You see where the debate goes there. And he argues that God uses, that's Bob's reply, that God uses oak trees, not mushrooms, for his purposes. But for Charles Colson, all the hullabaloo of politics was simply too much. Now, to bring this up to date, and this goes on beyond what I've gotten into the manuscript, when some people say, well, in politics it's always good, to go to the record. What's the information about how far along his candidacy has actually developed? What can we say in terms of hard cold numbers? Because politicians obviously have to be concerned with hard cold numbers. And admittedly, there are shortcomings with polls, but polls still are better than anything else that we have to go on. I always remember in 1964, it was LBJ versus Goldwater, and Gallup poll predicted Johnson would win by, he would have a margin of 60.1, and it came out to be 60.0. Which is pretty impressive, and they always say that every poll has a margin, of error of 3 points on either side. But anyway, Gallup poll, July of 1968. The Gallup people telephoned 2,405 adults or citizens and asked about the candidacy of Pat Robertson. This is in July of 1986. I've got one other poll to bring that right up to date, and then we'll make it here, so there'll be plenty of time for discussion. Okay, of the 2,405, 17% of that total number said that they were Christian fundamentalists as an announcement, really, of their particular faith. And of that 17%, all 17% said they had heard of Pat Robertson. So he was well known, obviously, the projection is, he's well known within his own religious community, within his own religious family, whatever term you want to use. Okay, now of the others who were polled, though, over half had not heard of him, of the general population. I'm not talking about registered Republicans or registered Democrats here, but of the total population, over half had not heard of him at all as a candidate. But that shouldn't be too surprising. I was talking with somebody, I guess it was with you folks yesterday on the hike, that in 1980, only 52.3% of all total eligible voters in this country voted for Carter or Reagan. Only 52.3. Then both parties got, you know, enormous voter registration, you know, procedures and programs going, beat the drums and all the rest, and it went up a staggering 0.6 tenths of a percent. It went from 52.3 in 1980 to 52.9% in 1984 in the Mondale Reagan sort of thing, which makes you wonder, you know, about how sophisticated or how conscientious American voters are. By contrast, in Europe, they get over 90%. In countries, Belgium, Holland, the Scandinavian countries and all the rest. One thing they do in Europe, which we might want to think about here, they vote on Sunday. Some people get excited, that's violating church and state, which I think is baloney, but you know, some people always have some kind of opinions. But we get 52.9, so it really shouldn't be surprising that a lot of people hadn't heard of Pat Robertson at all, unless they had tuned in to CBN or 700 Network on that. Okay, more on the statistics. Of those who had heard of him, other than the 17%, less than 20% were favorable for his candidacy for the presidency. And of all registered Republicans in the July Gallup poll, of all registered Republicans, the margin was 5-1% against him among registered Republicans with this. In a few weeks later, the Wall Street Journal had a poll which came up pretty much, this was 2,552 voters, stating that by 5-1 majority, these people were against any ordained minister entering the ministry, by a 5-1 majority on that. So you people, and then of course some of you who followed the Michigan primaries about 3 weeks ago, if anybody can make sense of how they elect people to elect people to elect people to, you know, to be the candidate, I'd be delighted if anybody could explain this. Time sort of went through it step by step, sentence by sentence. That didn't help. Newsweek, U.S. News, the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, the others still haven't been able to explain, and the Michigan people can't explain what was going on there. But what was interesting and important is Michigan was that, you know, 2.5 years before November 88, when that's a long time away before we're going to start voting, but they're having, you know, presidential referendums now. All the sides, Kemp, Bush, and Robertson, all spent big bucks trying to, you know, to sort of take the field and win in Michigan. And the results were extremely confusing, and they're sort of like the 12 blind men, each touching a different part of the elephant, and each coming up to a conclusion, you know, conclusion with what am I touching here? There was no momentum, there was no, you know, no groundswell, no voters rising up in righteous, in righteous indignation over this sort of thing. It was pretty much a bust. But what had happened, and it falls back to what I talked about before, that we depend so much nowadays on media events as necessary for, you know, getting public attention for these things. And Michigan was obviously a media event. Some of you were here when my son was teaching here 3-4 weeks ago. He lives in Detroit, and he kept sending me, he knew I was doing this research, and he kept sending me everything from the old Free Press and the Detroit Times and everything else, neighborhood newspapers and all the rest of these things. He was trying to explain to Dad what was going on, and he couldn't understand it, and he's heavily involved in Detroit politics, and I was too. The only thing you can say is that we were starting to spend a lot of money this early on, 2.5 years beforehand, in for politics, and the results are, in this case, are increasingly, you know, indecisive. Okay, now, let me sort of summarize and raise 4 or 5 questions for you here. And maybe this will help start the discussion. I see some eyelids slowly sinking here, so maybe we can pep up things a little bit. And I promise you, we won't take that. Might get you excited if I took up a collection. I might wake up some people. For my particular favorite candidate, and my particular candidate is somebody you'll have to wait to find out about later on. So no, seriously, if I'm a registered Democrat and I right now would like Bill Bradley or the Senator Bradley from New Jersey, but I would imagine that most people here have only a vague knowledge, and if you know Bill Bradley at all, you know he was on the world champion Knickerbockers in 1970 and 1973. But now he's a United States Senator and looks good, but I think he's got 2% of the public recognition factor right now on the latest Democratic, you know, poll. So, all right, anyway, some questions. First of all, about Robertson. Is Robertson, and some people have said this, is he trying to do what obviously Jesse Jackson tried to do in 1984? Be a stalking horse trying to get a voice on the platform committee for the fundamentalist Christian position, not really thinking that he's going to win the nomination, but thinking that if he gets enough clout or a block, if you like, a BLLC of voters, like the Solid South, you remember, used to be for FDR, or all the other voters and the blacks, what was it, 92% of the black vote in 1984 went for Mondale? You know, that's a trend. I mean, you know, there's no question, that's clear cut, that's block voting, 92%. Is he trying to do what Jesse Jackson tried to do? And Jackson, obviously, if those who remember watched the convention, had an enormous amount of clout because he knew that the people who made the decisions, you know, the Gary Harts and the Walter Mondales, would be having to listen to them because he could deliver the, you know, he could deliver the Democratic vote, the black Democratic vote, you know, where he wanted to. And it's possible that that Robertson is trying to do that, but then he can't say this. This is one of these things that where we have sort of legalized hypocrisy in America. In order to get enough votes through what we call the Political Action Committee system, the PAC system, you have to declare your candidacy by a certain time. But you can't declare that I'm only out to get 17% of the vote. You have to declare that you're out to get the presidency in order to qualify for public funds for your campaigning. So therefore, he has to make his statements that he's running for national office and not just running for, as I call it, a stalking horse for his particular, brand of Republicanism. All right. Now, in order, the second thing that the polls show so far, and we can't predict ahead of time what's going to happen, the second thing that I want to mention here, besides the problem about is he trying to imitate Jesse Jackson. In order to win now, I mean, people on all sides of the political spectrum say he would have to coax a lot of registered Democrats over to his particular position. The hardcore Republican, you know, vote that's deliverable simply isn't there so far. And it's going to be very interesting what the incumbent president, President Reagan, is going to say about this, because obviously Vice President George Bush has carried his water for him, obviously thinking that the payoff is going to come with the endorsement wherever the Republican convention comes in 1988. And how is he going to cope with the fact that that he's got people who support him because they see him as their, you know, as the first Christian, you know, as they, in their way of looking at things, you know, in the White House. Because obviously George Bush wasn't in there just to be vice president. Vice, just like Hubert Humphrey or the others, Richard Nixon under Ike, and all the rest of these people are there. LBJ under Kennedy, you can go through the whole litany here of all of them. They were there because they want to be president. Humphrey, I mentioned him, okay. So what's going to happen there? Will they be able to attract a significant number of registered Democrats for this? Okay, a third question that comes up, and I've hinted at this before, and I could have quoted more conservatives. George Will, for instance, probably the most respected conservative columnist, is very much afraid of the Robertson candidacy. National Review, Bill Buckley, and the others there have said some very critical things, and I think almost some religious, not almost, they are some religiously bigoted things against Robertson's candidacy, which I could read if you want me to do this. But my point is, does Robertson really have control over the Christian fundamentalists the way he would like to think that he does have? Or a fourth one, no, let's assume this is an interesting one, a speculation. Assuming there is a deliverable Christian fundamentalist vote, let's say 17%, because that's the best figure we have to work with right now. And that's really not unusual if you take other Gallup polls, you know, over the years on your state, people stating their religious preference. 17% really isn't too much for that now. Would the either or any of the four top runners, Bush, Kemp, Baker, or Dole, would their efforts to get this Christian fundamentalist bloc, would that perhaps drive some more moderate Republicans, you know, out of the Republican Party? You see, it's, you know, push. Remember what was it? Push me, pull you. That old song from going way back. There was a. It's like an escalator. Some are always getting off. Some are always getting on. But there has to be a calculated risk, obviously, on the part of the candidates for what their activities are going to mean in terms of, you know, right, center, left. All these different things. All right, and finally one, and I'm going to talk, I think it's on Wednesday, on the charismatic movement, and I'll talk just about it as a theological and a religious movement then. But since Pat Robertson is very carefully, very, very openly identified with the charismatic movement, might that actually alienate some other, you know, very conservative evangelical Christians? Because Falwell himself is very critical, for instance, of charismatics. The Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest single Protestant denomination in the country, is officially opposed in terms of theology and doctrine to that which we call the baptism of the Holy Spirit and the whole charismatic experience. And all this sums up the position that I'm trying to say here. Do we want to get, you know, this kind of issue into, you know, elective politics? Some of you heard me say, and I'll finish with this statement, that for a long time, when the president, whoever the president was, did speak out on what you might call religious moral issues, it was on things like Memorial Day or Thanksgiving Day or official proclamations. And what they always came up with, right through Jimmy Carter, was what I call Gerry Ford bland. They were very bland, inoffensive statements that eminently forgettable. That's the best way of putting them. Eminently forgettable. Nothing like Lincoln's Gettysburg Address or anything else like this. In just one last story on this, in 1984, Ford came to the Twin Cities to vote to campaign for some of the Republican candidates. Bill Frenzel, especially in the third, and he preached on a Sunday morning, and Ford has always been active in religious circles. He preached at the House of Hope Presbyterian Church in St. Paul, and his sermon was reported on page 23 of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, right where it should be. That's about as much news value as it had. And I would happen to agree with the Gerry Ford bland model for the presidency. And I know I've talked to some people already who say they're going to disagree with me on that one. So it's 9:12 or so, and so I'll be glad to stay as long as anybody is ready to raise questions. Martin Marty always says there's always a second question, but there's rarely a first question. And if any of you are from Roseville in St. Paul, that's his son who's running for the state senate, so think about it. He's also a history major from St. Olaf College, which is another reason to endorse John Marty for the state senate. You're just scratching. I was hoping you were going to ask a question. No? Sometimes, I remember I had a teacher, and she would start asking a question, and I thought I was going to be able to answer it, so the hand would sort of go up, and then all of a sudden, boy, it was a tougher question than I thought, so I'd start scratching. Okay. Questions, comments, disagreements, speeches, yes?
What is this platform and organization?
Oh, he has a non-profit, everything, this has to be said right away, everything he's done, everything Falwell has done through Moral Majority, Liberty Federation, Freedom Council, all of these are totally constitutional and legal. There was some question at the very, very beginning about some of these things. They don't violate the usual kind of provisions about clergy endorsement of specific political parties, because that would be unconstitutional. And all the rest. But his major group is called the Freedom Council, and these are people, and I'm on their mailing list, so I try to get everything I can. I try to go to their conventions and meetings and things. And I always, some of you have heard me say this, I always have to explain every time I get a new post, you know, we can't say postman anymore, can we? What do you?
Postperson?
Okay.
Post carrier,
that's a better one, seriously. Post carrier, they come in, and I get a lot of mail from a lot of different groups. And sometimes some things, and it was way out, some of them around here, some of these outfits you have out in Western Washington and, or Eastern Washington, I should say, and Idaho and all the rest, Posse Comitatus and Aryan Nation and some of these people, some real sweethearts. I mean, in Minnesota, a left-wing Democrat is sort of suspect, but we don't have anything like, you know, like people like that. So I get a lot of group from this, mail from these people, and I always have to tell the new post carrier that I'm only a professional researcher, and I don't really believe in the American Nazi Party or the Ku Klux Klan or things like that. This is a Hubert Humphrey kind of answer to your question. It takes about 10 minutes to get there. And then if the deadline comes, if the, you know, Face the Nation deadline comes, and I haven't answered the question, that's exactly what Hubert always was trying to do, is not answer the question. Okay. That's why I always voted for him. But he has a Freedom Council, which are the shock troops. They'll go out and ring the doorbells and press the flesh and raise the funds in all the 50 states. And he also is going for what we call PAC, or Political Action Committee, money, which is available. Some of you know on your 1040 checkoff, you can check off those things. That's where we get PAC, or Political Action Committee, money. And everything, that's where I got off the subject, everything has done is completely constitutional and legal with us. And these are out, doing the work now. They don't, they're in this particular game. They want us to know all of these people, and the same thing is true with Gary Hart, and I'm sure with Cuomo and some of the others on the Democratic side. They want us to know that they're interested, but we have to go through this fiction that they're not yet a candidate. Whereas if you went to George Bush's office in Washington, D.C., they got 200 people full-time working for 1988. But that everybody says this is the way it has to be, and because there's so much money at stake. But he does have a very active and totally legal, political apparatus going, which is not tax exempt. If you want to give money to his political campaign, that's not tax exempt. If you want to send money to 700 Club, and he has a wide range of charitable organizations, they call it Operation Blessing, which was sending money to the Sudan. You remember when that was a problem and all the rest. He's got a lot of programs like that going, and those are tax exempt. And he has a lot of lawyers working for him.
With that kind Robertson,
of yeah, Robertson. Yeah, I'm talking about. Yeah. Did I both of them? Yeah, because Sal Fowell had a relief program for the Sudan and for Ethiopia too. Good. Got a big crowd. I just assume.
Can I make a comment on
sure.
Colson? Because just recently I've gotten just interested as a matter of curiosity.
Sure.
I began watching the 700 Club in the mornings, as well as mainly I like his little segment called Perspective. But while he was off campaigning, it appeared like his very best friend came to take his place and hold the program because he was out of town, and it was understood. Who would you guess that best friend was?
Was it Colson?
Yes, Colson was there.
He said some,
But he sounded like he was the best buddy. He was keeping the thing afloat while Robertson was off running around the country. This is just very recently.
Yeah, my quotation came from something he said in June. And this is the freshest I've come up with. That was reported.
This was in August. Then another thing that was really amusing is and he's got a good sense of humor because he can handle this. Someone had criticized him for his baby face.
His baby face. That's typical in American politics. I remember one day I was sitting out where I could hear some youngsters going by to go to grade school, and I knew who their fathers were because they were colleagues of mine. And they said, we're not going to vote for Karl Rovog for governor of Minnesota because he's got a mule face. And the boys had obviously picked that up from their father. And Bobby Kennedy's haircut. Remember, that was a major issue for a long time.
Robertson handled it so well, obviously, yeah. His little groupie. They made what a joke. They laughed. It was so funny. And
you have to be careful.
They had to laugh with them,
Sometimes, and I don't say this is true for Robertson, but sometimes those are planted. Sometimes those are what we call fat pitches that the candidate can hit out of the ballpark.
You say it first before someone says it to you?
No, but you have one of your own people. It's like a shill in Las Vegas. You have somebody say it for you because then you can hit it for a home run. George Wallace was famous at that. 1968, when he was running for the American thing, he would give dope to hippies who would then sit up in the balcony and make noise and demonstrate and all the rest of these things. And then after they had carried on for a while, and he said, that's the kind of people we're going to get rid of in America. And then everybody would send in their $10 and $20 for George Wallace's party. Sure. That's an old and dishonorable technique that goes way back to the days of Andrew Jackson. I don't want to give a lecture on that, but that's a classic old technique that you have to be careful. I'm sure Robertson is above that. I don't have any doubts that he would do that, but it's possible in politics. Sure.
You mean the best defense is a good...
Well, remember, Nixon's dirty tricks. There would be the best example of it. He planted people. You remember that time when, who was it, Ed Muskie from Maine cried in front of national television cameras because they had, and that was, what was his name, Donald something or other, who had been one of the plumbers. And that had been planted by the Republican National Committee to do, what was that jerk's name, I remember? Donald Segretti? Yeah, sure, Donald Segretti. There it goes. So that's a good word for my crossword puzzle interest. But Segretti, and then he confessed to this afterwards. He had written this phony letter. And remember Muskie standing out with the snow and all the rest of these things because Muskie was going for the presidency in 1972 against McGovern and the rest. And that turned out to be a total fabrication. But everybody does it. The Democrats do this. They have spies in the candidacies, and in the offices of the others. So you have to be very careful. I didn't want to get off the sidelight on that. But politics, is survival kind of stuff.
Strange.
Very, very, very. And on the other hand, I don't know. I guess that would sound like a sermon, and you get enough of those.
Well, if you were a Christian politician, couldn't you say? be wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove?
Yeah, I just, my own personal feeling is that I want to be very careful that we don't identify one specific issue. Like, let's say the tax reform bill right now that they're doing with Ross Dontowski and Packwood, that there is the Christian position on tax reform. That's what I'm afraid of. The Christian position on foreign aid, or the Christian position on tariffs. Or, remember, they got all excited with the moral report cards that if you voted against if you voted for tax relief for New York City, remember that one? That was a no-no on the Christian voice or moral report card. Or there is the Christian position on the Panama Canal. That was another favorite of mine. I always remember the wonderful New Yorker cartoon on that, just marvelous. It was a very, you know, what we call a Wall Street banker type, sitting in a breakfast, at a breakfast counter, and the waitress was coming over there to give him breakfast, and this, you know, this big bucks guy was saying, "Boy, if we give up the Panama Canal, you can kiss bananas goodbye." And that's the reason why we should keep the... But they put this up, and that's what I'm trying to say, is that when you talk about the Christian position, then we get going, then there has to be a Jewish position, and there has to be an agnostic position, and a humanist position, and all the rest of these things. And to me, politics, you know what Bismarck said, politics is the art of the possible. And politics going right, if you want to quote founding fathers, our best founding father was James Madison, and he deliberately set up the provision so that the process of making legislation was give and take among competing, you know, among competing groups, and that every group should have an equal right to have a voice, you know, in the say of this: business, agriculture, farming, you know, whatever, commercial, whatever you want, labor management, all these things should have a voice with this. But that they're out of the conflict should come the bill that profited and was what the whole country wanted. And it wasn't identified with the will of God. He quoted Voltaire on that. It was a wonderful thing. Why we have separation of church and state. Voltaire said, and I think I used this last time too. Voltaire said, if there was only one religion, we would have total tyranny, as we did have under Martin Luther in some places, and under John Calvin, and under the Catholics, and so on and forth. He said also, if we have only two religions, they'll be at each other's throats all the time, killing each other, which happened. And when Gustavus Adolphus, among others, you remember, tried to, you know, Christianize Germany by the sword. But he said, if you have a lot of different groups all competing, they'll live in harmony with one another. That's what I think is necessary in the political realm also. And that every group is just as, how do I say this? Every group is just as valid. Every group's position, that's what I want to say, every group's position is just as valid as every other group's. And if to paint, or to point, or that's what it is, to put a label of Christian or Jewish or humanist or anything else on it, I think is distorting the position, because you're claiming some sort of credence. Jerry Falwell finds capitalism in the Old Testament. It's an astounding, what we call exegesis, absolutely an amazing performance. If you can find capitalism, you know, free enterprise, market capitalism in the Old Testament, you know, let me know. I'd certainly be interested with this, but he wants to find it. He wants to find, you know, wants to prove that capitalism is the best system of business organization. To me, capitalism is one useful way and one reasonably successful way of organizing the economy, but it's not the only way of doing this. And hence, when you start from, this is deductive reasoning as he does, if you start from a position and saying what we have in this country is best in God's will, then you have to go back in the Bible and find it. And it isn't there. I mean, if you want to go to the Bible, let's talk about Acts 2, where they sell all their property and share all things in common. That's the first congregation. And that's not capitalism. You know, giving every person their due. But that's another story. I got way off. That's another Hubert Humphrey kind of response to your question. But that's the thing. And then you get into the business I was talking about with my friends when we were hiking, that you get into the position of sort of voting on the orthodoxy of a candidate. How does he stand on virgin birth? How does he stand on physical resurrection? How does he stand on, you know, what we call the last times? Is he sound there? Is he sound on scripture and on all these things? That's where I think we get into some real trouble. On the other hand, as you were pointing out, we have every right to ask, is this person a person of absolutely impeccable, you know, moral character, honest, reliable, dependable, all these things that are necessary to go along with the trust in the candidate themselves.
but not to decide whether or not if they're Presbyterian versus whether or not they're, you know, the Methodist or something else like that. That's very scary. But every right to know what their background is, their position, are they people of real, you know, real character and integrity? And yeah.
Getting back to Robertson again.
Sure.
won't his religious commitment be in opposition to our laws that you go mix church and state?
Well, that's, you know, that's one of those things that become very, very difficult to sort of pin down once you get to specifics. And what we've decided in this country on the basis of the First Amendment, because that's where we have, you know, no establishment of religion and then no prevention of what we call the free exercise of religion. So that is what we're saying in the First Amendment. This is, I'll get to Robertson on this one. Just wave if I don't after 10 minutes. But anyway, what we're saying there is that the government shouldn't have a state church such as we have, you know, in England and in, you know, Scandinavian countries. And many of you have been to, you know, the Scandinavian countries or England, you know how dynamic the churches are there. So that, the government is to stay away from that. But on the other hand, the government is not to prevent what we call free exercise of religion. If you want to have, you know, if you want to have a fairly kooky, you know, by our traditional standards, religion, and if it doesn't violate other laws, like as Jehovah's Witnesses have with blood transfusion and things like that, then obviously that's okay, and you shouldn't, you know, shouldn't legislate against a group just because it has some weird ideas. They were tested. What's this one group down in the West Indies? They were smoking pot as part of their liturgy. And everybody was having a great time, and they claimed religious freedom, you know, on the basis of that. Okay, so what we have then, to get to the point, what we have is a constitutional issue. And what we've decided in this country is that the Supreme Court is the agency which decides, you know, the how high the wall of separation should be between church and state. And what the Supreme Court has clearly is a very pragmatic solution to this problem. For one thing, the Supreme Court usually doesn't like to touch religious issues. You can say, for instance, just two things. The United States Treasury pays for the salaries of chaplains. That sounds like government supporting religion. The state legislatures and the U.S. Congress have opening prayers. Richard Halverson, isn't he the Senate chaplain, I think? And people like that. That sounds like government endorsement of religion. In God We Trust, on the coins. On the other hand, just to show you the pragmatic sort of thing here, of course, with then the throwing out of Bible reading and voluntary prayer in the public schools. The 62 and the 63 decisions are a good example. But one which came up, well, two, one for the people in Washington, was a fascinating case here about the blind fellow. When the blind people get public, you know, support, he wanted to use his public taxpayer revenue to go to a Bible college. This came up, wasn't it, this spring in Washington State? Yeah, at Olympia. And the government upheld his decision that he could go to a Bible school, so he was using public funds to go to a sectarian institution. Well, you know, some of our friends from the American Civil Liberties Union and all the rest thought this is not separation of church and state. On the other hand, the Supreme Court did something which some people would say was just the opposite. There was a Jewish rabbi who was a chaplain that wanted to use his prayer scope when he was doing his official services or ceremonies and rituals, and the Supreme Court said no. That is using religious ritual in a public service, which is the military. So what you have then is, and the classic of all, and I talked about this the last time too, is whether or not you can have creches or manger scenes, you know, on public property. And that's, well, I don't want to even start on, you know, but I'm glad Chief Justice Berger retired, because he made everybody mad, you know, with his decision on that one. And so it goes back and forth. And the pendulum swings, you know, different ways. Now, we can tell pretty much ahead of time how justices who are appointed are going to vote on, let's say, something like abortion. It's clear that if there are two more votes that the Reagan administration gets, they're going to throw out the 1973 thing. So you can tell that ahead of time. You can tell on other issues, but you can never tell ahead of time how a potential associate justice is going to vote on Supreme Court. I mean, on church-state issues. And so therefore, Robertson has every right to advocate as strongly as possible what he's doing, because there is no clear, precise tradition which says that everything he does is right or everything that he does is wrong. My guess is that if he put forward his whole program to Supreme Court, let's say they enacted it or they ruled on it over the next 10 years, it'd probably come out about 50-50, because the Supreme Court doesn't want to lean too much one way or the other. So what I'm saying is that Robertson or Jesse Jackson, he's an ordained Baptist minister, and all the rest have every right to advocate these things as strongly as possible, but we've decided for better or worse, and sometimes it's worse for some of the Supreme Court decisions, that the Supreme Court is the agency which is going to solve these things, because the traditional idea of the Founding Fathers was that the Supreme Court was to be, you know, the Olympian people who stood above. They didn't have to go out and campaign and, you know, what I say, kiss babies and do all the rest. They're in for life, and we've only thrown out a couple. Remember Abe Fortas? He was kind of a rascal, and they threw him out. But very hard to get somebody out of the Supreme Court. And yeah, does that help? Okay, because I got it back to Robertson. What I'm trying to say is that Robertson has every right to advocate what he's saying. And then the only way we can decide it is either vote Robertson down at the Republican.